Welcome back to the Ed Morrissey Show podcast. Joining us, as always, the Prince of Twitter, the Regent of RedState.com, Andrew Malcolm, at A.H. Malcolm, on the now Donald Trump endorsed Twitter platform, or X. Trump's back on Twitter. I mean, I'm assuming, yeah, as Prince, you were aware of this and maybe even helped arrange it.
No, I heard about it today, and I was puzzled that what I saw did not explain how he got out of the legal bindings that he had on his Truth Social, but maybe that'll come later.
Well, I've heard that he actually wasn't barred from doing that. I think there might be some sort of agreement that he's going to do most of his social media stuff on Truth Social, because he's got investors in that. It's not just his platform. He's got investors in it. Because he's really the only draw on Truth
Social. Yeah, exactly.
The problem is that while it's not America, there is a much bigger audience on Twitter/X, and it's the audience you want to influence, right? It's the people who are, you know, overly online. And you can't just leave. I mean, this is sort of what I was writing this morning. You can't just leave that to Harris and Waltz. You have to be on there and engaging in it.
And Vance is on there. So, it makes sense. And, you know, you could read into it the fact that he finally realizes his campaign is in something of a trouble, and he wants to try to fix things. But he could fix things like that with his behavior, but so far, not good.
Yeah, by the time this goes up on Tuesday, I will have already written a post for Monday early evening called The Honeymooners. And it's looking at the polls, which I'll get to in a minute. But just to stay on Trump and Twitter, Elon Musk is going to do an interview with Trump tonight in Eastern time. I probably won't get a chance to watch it because I have other commitments on Monday nights. But and I'm not sure that it's going to be a huge, newsy sort of thing, more so than any other kind of interview that Trump is doing. But I do think it shows that Trump is doing interviews, which is more than Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are doing.
And it's why he's doing them. When she was not doing press conferences last week, he did one. And of course, the media found things to complain about, but he's doing it and she's not. He was, I think, the most media accessible president ever during his term. And not always to his benefit, but to the country's benefit, in the sense that they got to see him all the time, often, sometimes 4, 5, 6 times a day. If he was on the way to the helicopter, he'd stop and do a little scrum with the media. They could ask him about stuff. And he led the questions. He's got to get better at steering the interviews, but he let the questions steer what he said. And sometimes that went against his team's weekly messaging.
Right.
So, but when he did that black journalist interview, he let them take full control, and he slid back into his punching down. It's not necessary. They asked him about Kamala Harris being black, and then he got into all the part about how he wasn't sure sometimes and blah blah blah. Well, that doesn't help his campaign. In fact, it probably hurts it. Media politics 101, and I wrote this a week ago in the column, is you take control of the question. You're not a victim. You're not offering yourself up to be shot. So they ask you something you don't want to talk about. And you say, that's a good point. And then you go on and talk about what you want to talk about. He could have said, look, I don't care about people's color. And I think my administration showed that. In fact, and then he could go into how he got historic lows for black unemployment and blah, blah, blah. and talk about what his agenda is. But instead, he got into a messy fight with the black journalists, and they got a lot of news coverage, which is what they were after. And it, you know, threw a little mud on the windshield of his campaign. He just needs to be more disciplined. I'm not sure he can be, but he does need to be if he can do that. And since she came into the race, he's acted a little, he and his campaign, a little bit unorganized, you know.
I think they had a good idea about how to run against Biden, right?
And, yeah, exactly.
And I think that they have not yet realized
what this
is. And again, I kind of get into this in this post that I wrote called The Honeymooners, which is that, I mean, it's a completely different race now, not just because, you know, Harris is a woman or Harris is black. It's just that Harris isn't Biden. And this was a, this is a Trump Biden race for months, really for a year. I mean,
yeah,
we knew Biden for sure. And Trump looked like he was a lock. So for a year, people have been in the rematch mode. And I wrote, I think it was over a year ago, that the first party that offers something else other than a rematch is likely to win. And right now, I think we're in the glow of that. It's not a big glow, though. I mean, there's been some movement in the polls. And of course, we're not done yet because we got to get through next week's convention. I mean, that's still a week away. The start of the convention is a week away. And probably you won't see any sort of reset in the polling until Labor Day, just because the way that the polls work, right? But I mean, that's what this race is now. It's a completely different kind of race. And I don't think that exactly. The Trump team's figured this out yet. I mean, maybe they're starting to figure it out now.
Well, they're trying to run against her as Vice President Biden, and it doesn't work. You know, she has more energy. She's not senile. She's empty-headed and clueless. I mean, you see some of the things she's done, you know, explaining the cloud online.
She actually thought it was a cloud.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's up here above us.
Tell you, it doesn't have any physical location. Yes, in fact it does. And it's not up here.
I know. I put that in my column on Sunday. There's that, but there's also other things where she's explaining things as if the audience doesn't know it, and as if they're children.
Talking
down to them. The what explanation?
Ukraine explanation.
Yeah.
Well, you know, she was asked about the Ukraine war because they wanted to know about policy. Well, Ukraine is a small country. Next to a bigger country called Russia, and Russia,
yeah, I know.
That's bad.
It's like a third grader who didn't read the assignment, but she's trying to bluff her way through the report. And she talks down to people, which I don't think in the long term is going to work. You know, there's a lot of enthusiasm, and you got Tim Walz dancing on the stage and. and all of that. If she can keep this honeymoon momentum going, she could win. I mean, she's fresher than Trump, fresher and more alive than Biden, dim-witted, but it's a woman, it's history, the media's doing that. I saw a report that Biden has his hand in there helping her run like the first black, like he did. And David Plouffe joined her campaign, who was Biden's campaign manager. I mean, Obama's campaign manager for a while. So, yeah, it's a rough patch for Trump. And, you know, let's see, 40, the early voting can start in some places 46 days before November 5th. So we're back into late September. So
Right.
He needs to readjust his transmission here.
It's got to be pretty soon, right? I mean, it really does.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I agree with you on this because it's I think that people are not quite realizing. I don't think the Trump campaign is quite realizing that the timeline here is short because of all the early voting that's going to go on. I'm not sure how much of that takes place in the swing states. Like Pennsylvania, I know it does. But I mean, when you take a look at the 3 weeks, it's been 3 weeks since Harris was anointed as the nominee. It's been a week since she picked Waltz. And we actually haven't seen a lot of polling about the Waltz pick yet, about whether that's impacted the race. But basically what this has done is it's reset the race. Yes, it is now a different kind of campaign, but polling wise, it's really not that much different. She's up a little bit in national polls. The battleground states, at least so far, have been more or less a wash. I think Wisconsin's the only thing that actually flipped over from one column to another so far. Again, this is so far, still early days too. So I don't know that it's had a large impact on the race. And it is coming at a time too, and this is kind of really what I wanted to talk to you about, when the mainstream media is doing everything it can to coddle Harris.
Yeah.
I mean, I think this is after we talked last week. In fact, I know it was. The Politico ran a Politico playbook. It was in their newsletter. It wasn't even really a report. It was in their newsletter. Reported that the pool reporters on Air Force Two, that's traveling with Harris on the campaign, are engaging in off-the-record conversations with her. Yeah. And so therefore and that's it. That's all she's giving them. And so therefore the campaign doesn't feel like there's any real pressing need for her to answer questions on the record or hold press conferences or do interviews.
Exactly.
I mean, how sustainable is that? These guys.
Well, it is for a while, I think. First of all, a lot of people are still on vacation. Schools are just restarting. She's got this glow of a honeymoon going. Yes. And if she sat down with somebody who put the torch to her with some tough questions, that would ruin everything. And that, talk about reset, that would reset the campaign the way the debate reset Biden's campaign or torpedoed Biden's campaign.
It's a hell of a reset.
Yeah. So she's gonna coast on this as long as she can. And it's pretty smart on her part. If Trump was doing that, you would hear constant drumbeat from the media about we need access, this presidential campaign, blah, blah, blah. Well, we're not getting that drumbeat because one, the media is liberal, but two, she's smartly or following David Plouffe's advice or somebody's advice on the campaign plane. She goes to the back of the plane and schmoozes with the reporters. Hey, how's everything going? Everybody, are these guys helping you out? You getting everything you need? Anybody thirsty? And they'll ask her questions, but since it's off the record, if she doesn't know the answer, it doesn't matter. But she has learned what the media is interested in. And right. she will have a recording of it. And then they will go back and they say, okay, the media is going to ask you about Ukraine. The media is going to ask you about the Mideast. And they're going to come up with answers for her to memorize or for them to put on the teleprompter. So it's very useful for her, and it lets the steam off from any potential media grousing about they don't have access. They do have access. It's just that she's protected herself. And that's pretty smart.
Well, yeah, it's pretty smart, but it's not sustainable. And you're already starting And so a couple of things on this. First off, the Washington Post editorial board on Sunday night, or Monday morning, depending on how you read timestamps and newspapers, demanded that Kamala Harris start taking questions, right? And doing interviews and providing policy statements. And it's actually a pretty good, this is the editorial board. This is not an op-ed column. This is the editorial board said, enough of this. It's time for her to start being specific and going on the record. And it's actually a pretty good piece. I mean, they talk about the fact that she's flip-flopped on basically everything that she ran on in 2019, and she hasn't explained it, which means that nobody's going to buy it. And This is the Washington Post. I mean, this isn't the Washington.
No, you're right.
I mean, it's a pretty tough editorial for what it's worth, right? And I think, you know, the New York Times started to sort of signal this on Friday, and this was a funny thing. Jim Tankersley, who's a pretty decent economic analyst for the New York Times, you know, his stuff is generally pretty good. Did a deep dive-ish on Donald Trump's tax plan, especially the plan to end taxes on Social Security, which is going to be enormously expensive. And, you know, he talked about how much, if you start adding this up, there's an awful lot of revenue that's going to go away. And, you know, where is it going to come back from? And so he's doing analysis on this. He says, you know, and Harris hasn't provided us any information. Yeah. So we can't judge it. And so the headline actually said, Trump's tax plan will cost trillions. Harris's plans are missing, right? That was the headline. And I was thinking, wow. And then a few hours later, I started getting emails from people. Did you see that the New York Times changed that headline?
Yeah.
Oh, really? Harris's plans track Biden's. So clearly,
whatever the hell that is,
they saw that, and the campaign went back to the New York Times. I don't think they went to Tankersley because the story actually changed, just the headline. I think they went back to the New York Times and talked to a friendly editor who went back in and did a little quick finger, you know, little fingers on the keyboard sort of thing, and changed that. But I mean, it's starting to build up that the media is a little frustrated by this now too, which means that she's going to have to start getting in front of people and start explaining. And I think you're right. When she starts explaining, she starts losing because she can't explain anything. But again, you know, you've got a 78-year-old guy who's going up against a woman in her mid-50s, I think it is, mid to late 50s.
59.
59, so almost 60. Okay, so it's not that much of a difference, but enough. It's a significant difference, almost 20 years. And she's replacing the really old dude who was basically non compos mentis in a debate. And I'm wondering if it's really going to be another debate before Trump gets an opportunity to reset this equation. Because I don't know that just simply throwing criticism out at her and trying to press the media into being tough on her is going to change that trajectory.
No, you're absolutely right. I don't believe it is either. And I think I could spend a long work week trying to find people who knew anything about the New York Times editorial or the Washington Post editorial.
Oh yeah.
But it is an indicator, you know, it's kind of like water starting to seep up out of the ground. It is an indicator of a frustration building. But she gets the benefit of the doubt. Her campaign does. I'm sure Plouffe or whomever is there is. This campaign of Kamala's is not being run by her sister like it was in 2020. So... she's got some professionals in there. They were professionals from Anita Dunn has left from the campaign, but she's got some Biden professionals there. So we're kind of in an interim stage, but it's a worrisome stage for Republicans or people who don't want Kamala Harris to be president. It's worrisome. There's still time to go, but you're right. He needs to start recalibrating soon. And the recalibration is mainly being disciplined. You know, you got today's message on Kamala, stick to it. And he's doing a rally. Where was it? Pennsylvania here in a few days. He loves the rallies. He loves the crowds cheering for him. This one you'll notice is going to be indoors. So, won't have to worry about slanted roofs in the neighborhood.
The Secret Service requested that they stick to indoor venues. Yeah. I don't know how, I mean, frankly, if I had just had my ear pierced by a, you know,
yeah, I go along with
that idea. So, yeah, I don't need to be outdoors. maybe you guys should be doing your job better. But yeah, in the meantime,
what you do is you carefully pick an arena that isn't that big, so you can have a huge overflow crowd outside. You can put up a big screen, and the media can cover about thousands of people trying to get in, and they can't. If you pick some huge thing like the Michigan Stadium or something, takes 101,000 people, then the media is going to focus on all those sections that are empty. So, you know, there's some strategy going on in this. Indoors is fine. It's easier to fill it up. I think we've moved past the outdoor business. It's just too risky. I mean, it's too risky for the country. Even if you don't like Trump, something terrible happening to him or her is just going to tear the place apart. Exactly. We just can't have it.
You know, I mean, this to me was the reason why I thought that there was the hand of providence here, either that or just extremely, extremely good luck. But I thought it was the hand of providence, not because I think that God loves Donald Trump more than he loves other people, right? Or that God somehow loves Donald Trump but doesn't love Corey Comparatore, who was the guy who died in that attack. My take on that, and I suspect this was Donald Trump's take on it too, and the media probably didn't really want to delve into this too much, was that this was the hand of providence for the country, not for Donald Trump, because had he been killed in that assassination attempt, this place would have been insane. It would have been Mark Antony waving the bloody shirt at the Republican National Convention, and it would have been horrible. Horrible for the country. I think that's a hand of providence.
And it did. And he started behaving really presidential. And at the convention, his demeanor was different. His speech went on too long, but it began. It was very, I've been changed. It was a life changing moment, and it was focused on content. Not she's a dummy airhead and he's a poo-poo pants. You know, it wasn't all that stuff. Yeah, and he had his face when the others were speaking, even Nikki Haley. I haven't been a huge Trump fan, but he looked calmer and more in control, which I think is what people want for a president. We have a sense now after the Biden months. There's no real control. I part of my Sunday post was who's running the show? We don't see Biden. I guess tomorrow or Tuesday, he's going to New Orleans for fundraising for cancer.
Same place too. I think. Either it's on Tuesday or it's coming up this week where he and Harris are going to do a joint appearance for the campaign
too. Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. Okay. Well,
you mentioned the Anita Dunn thing. I want to just get back to that for a second. Did you read that thing in Politico that Anita Dunn, the interview that Anita Dunn did with Politico?
No, I didn't see the interview.
Well, I mean, I don't think they had video of it. It was just transcribed. And she was not at all diplomatic about who she blames for Joe Biden being pushed out of the race. And that's Nancy Pelosi, who she said basically triggered the whole thing and actively pushed him out of the campaign. And, you know, Anita Dunn's been around for a while. She's a, you know, Obamaite. She's been around Biden for a long time. Yeah. And she's now transferring over to Kamala Harris's campaign. I think you mentioned that too. And, but she wants to make sure everybody knows that it was Nancy Pelosi that pulled the Brutus Act.
I've not been a fan of Nancy Pelosi's. I had a little bit to do with her back in the 2000 campaign, and she was the most nausea-inducing, suck-up, unctuous woman. Her people asked me to set up a meeting with George W. Bush, so we did at the Fresno airport. And Laura Bush was there. It was a private meeting in one of the meeting rooms. And Nancy Pelosi, I mean, I'm so looking forward to working with you, Governor. I've been so admiring of what you did in Texas. I mean, it was just, you know, I exchanged a look with some people there, but it, so she didn't come across as the great power broker, but since then, or maybe at the same time, I don't know, she's not been a suck up to anybody. And she was, you know, speaker twice and was in control and organized the two impeachments of Trump and was a great supporter of Biden's until she wasn't. And she did an interview that I mentioned in Sunday's column that no, she hasn't talked to President Biden since he stepped down. But he knows how much I love him. That's what she said. That's a quote.
And by the way, that knife is sticking out of his back. The angle shows how much I love him. I missed all of the important organs.
And you know, from a political point of view, what she did was smart and brave and necessary. There wasn't anybody else, Chuck Schumer, doofus. It wasn't anybody else prepared to do that or who had the clout with Biden. And someday we may find out exactly how she did it. But there were threats. And as I understand it, some phrasing like, well, we can do this the easy way or we can do this the hard way. And I don't know what the hard way would have involved, but I suspect some revelations that the Biden corporate trust did not want to endure.
Well, and what Anita Dunn said was just basically that that congressional Democrats fueled by Nancy Pelosi basically said, "You're killing us." And that was,
and it was true. It was true.
Well, it is true. But I mean, this whole thing is just sleazy as hell.
And they're trying to ignore that they've been covering it up the whole time. They could have taken care of this, 16 months ago when he was dilly-dallying about whether he's going to run again. They could go in. Of course, his symptoms were not quite as bad then, but they were bad. They could have gone in and said, you know, no, and controlled the primaries, but they didn't. They set it up for him. So they got what they deserved, a mess.
I agree. And by the way, they knew as early as April of 2022 when they sent the Easter Bunny in there to block him from talking to reporters and people on the line at a White House. April. I mean, that's on video. That's the president of the United States being ordered away from the line by the Easter Bunny. I mean,
And he was comfortable. You know, I don't know how many times he said, "Well, they tell me I shouldn't take questions, or I'm going to get in trouble with this." Who's the president of the United States going to get in trouble with? Maybe his wife, but
People who control his ice cream.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Ice cream. That's what it is, Andrew.
No sprinkles for you tonight, Joe.
You weren't a good boy. You were not a good boy. You talked to reporters and you weren't supposed to do that. No sprinkles for you. Yeah. Before we lose the entire episode, though, I got to talk to you a little bit about your earlier post over at Red State, which is about the plea deal for 9/11. Plotters that ended up getting canceled by Lloyd Austin. And you know, I'm torn on this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's good reasons for it.
I on one hand, I want to see them get executed, and on the other hand, I'd really like to see them get executed. However, the problem is that they're never going to be able to do anything with this. And I kind of understood why they were going down the plea deal route, was because there's no resolution to this thing. These guys are just going to have to die in Gitmo. They're just going to have to keep them there until they die without ever coming to a resolution to this case, because the earlier administrations, this is true of the Bush administration too, decided that they were going to put terrorists through terrorists who had committed terror crimes while outside the jurisdiction of the United States into the civil criminal courts of the United States for adjudication, which is nonsense. We declared war for a reason.
It's ridiculous. And I don't know how that. Yeah, I don't know why they would do it. Well, this agreement was deep six, like Osama bin Laden's body. I mean, it was over. If you look into it, I agree with you. I would, two choices: kill them or kill them. But they were in trouble because of the waterboarding. Yep. And if that showed up in a civilian trial, then they go innocent. You could never release those guys because you decided to do it in the wrong place. You did the wrong kind of interrogation. I understand why they did it at the time, but so they've been, the prosecution team and the Pentagon have been stretching this thing along and trying to find some way out. And they finally convinced them to plead guilty so they could say, well, we got them. But the blowback was too much for Austin, who's not exactly Paul Revere, but it was too much for Lloyd Austin. So he deep sixed the plea deal. And now we're back where we were before, is they really can't go to trial in a civilian court. They're stuck with them there. It's very expensive, but I don't think anyone in the Pentagon cares about how much expense it is. They just don't want the trouble. So let them rot down there. I don't know if they have cable TV, but they would in maximum security and air conditioning and three squares a day. And they probably get their own prayer rug that will, you know.
Three hots in a cot.
Yeah.
Three hots in a cot.
Yeah,
and, I mean, it's been 23 years.
It's 23 years.
We're coming up to the 23rd anniversary of 9/11. We've had these guys in custody for 20 years.
Yeah,
we got them in 2003, right? 21 years. We're coming up to 21 years that we've had these guys in custody. This thing should have been over in 6 months.
Yeah.
And again, so I'm a little, I understand why they were trying to get to the plea deal. Right? Because they just wanted to get it out so that they didn't have to deal with this. Then they could send them into Supermaxes in Florence or wherever. We have, I think, 3 or 4 Supermax facilities inside the United States. And there they would stay for the rest of their natural lives, unnatural lives, whatever they are. I get why they were doing it. Because Congress boxed in the Department of Defense on this. And, but how do you make that decision in election year? How do you make that decision in election year?
Yeah. Well, the general that oversaw it, she was retired and she was also relieved at that job. But I understand, her mission was wrap this thing up. And so she did. Now, she wasn't thinking, how will this affect November 5th? Lloyd Austin has to. And, I suspect that Mr. Courage was phoned by the White House and say, hey, we can't give them, let them off the hook.
Are you kidding me?
They killed 3,000 people. And you're going to, but we don't like death penalty. Well, sometimes. And that's something I did some research for the New York Times a while back, and I did a piece that I guess they weren't all that happy with, but and it pointed out how lawyers plant mistakes in trials of murder people with the death penalty so that they can have grounds for appeal and keep it going. And I wrote about one guy who had been on appeal for 23 years. 23 years. He left this poor school one-room schoolhouse teacher to freeze to death after sodomizing her out by a barn. But he did get it in the end. And I understand people say, well, we shouldn't be doing the death penalty because they did the death penalty. Well, but some crimes, not all murders, but some of them require that you eliminate this person from society. They forfeited their right to live in a civilized society. And It's unpleasant, but what they did is unpleasant. And you'll notice the media always calls it by the inmates, the condemned's name, not by the victim's name. Well, what we did and what we did in Montana when I was there, we called the case by the victim's name. And the hell with the with the guy who got
Well, there you go. But I mean, it's yeah, but and I agree. I think it's a great idea. I think I think the media should stick to that policy too. Hard to do with 9/11 though, because there's 3,000 victims, right? But you can call them the 9/11 conspirators, and generally speaking, that's what we do with
these
guys. But I mean, I have problems with the death penalty in civil cases. Although I think that there are some cases where you kind of have to really, unless you really have a firm, you know, theological or ideological opposition to the death penalty, there are some where you're going, well, maybe this guy should get it. I may not like the death penalty, but this guy probably should get it. But that's the reason why you don't put the 9/11 guys into the civil.
Exactly. Exactly.
This isn't a civil case. It's not the civil death penalty. This is war. And
that's what it was.
Those kinds of atrocities in war, then you have forfeited your right to live in a military sense, and it becomes a military action, which is much more applicable. The death penalty becomes a lot more applicable under those circumstances. And so this is the reason why I wanted to talk about it is that just this, the roots of this go back to, I think it was about 2004 or 2005 when they were starting to get these guys off, you know, out of Afghanistan. They're starting to find these Al-Qaeda guys in Afghanistan and elsewhere. And Congress got involved in it, saying, well, you can't set it, you can't do this through military tribunals. You have to do it through the, you have to do it through the justice system. It's like, why?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
I could almost see it for a guy like John Walker Lind, who was an American citizen that was captured and was responsible for the murder of, what was his name? Mike Spann, I think it is. He was a CIA guy in Afghanistan. And he's out, by the way. He's been released, even though he committed murder.
Bo Bergdahl.
Yeah, you know, the deserter. Yeah, exactly. So this is part of not taking war seriously by the American electorate. And this is, this goes back 20 something years of not taking it seriously. It's not just recent.
No, that's, you're absolutely right. And it's a weakness in one sense of our society with, and the world plays us with it. You know, they come in and kill 3,000 people and then, okay, so they lose a couple of their guys. There's thousands of others waiting in line to get. You know, I saw a mock interview with, after they killed the ISIS leader in the, when he blew himself up in the tunnel with a couple of his kids. He said there was an interview of the new ISIS leader, and I said, you know, where do you see yourself in 5 years? He's like, dead. Yeah, I don't understand. They just announced, who was it? They announced the new head of some terror group. Oh,
Yeah, Sinwar. Yahya Sinwar.
Yeah, yeah, the one in Gaza. Yeah, he gets totaled in Iran. Like, okay, next, it's him. Hey, I'm over here. Oh well.
Yeah.
No, it's sad. It's sad. It's sad.
All right. Well, but
what's not sad is that I have a couple of jokes, Ed.
There you go. That's what I was looking for.
Yeah. One of them is this guy's this patient in the hospital. He's waiting to go into some serious surgery. And the doctor comes in. He's getting ready as a stethoscope. And he says, oh, okay. He's talking to the patient. He says, okay, Mike, calm down. You've got this. And the patient says, my name's not Mike. And the doctor said, no, mine is. I like that one. And and another one is that if you get an email with the subject line "knock knock," do not open it because it's from the Jehovah's Witnesses.
Well, that's pretty good. I like that. I like that. All right. I've got one. I've got at least one. I can get for you. Let me go ahead and pull this up right now because I did look around. I didn't go on Instagram, which is where I should have gone. But so you got two guys and they're driving down the road and they're drinking beers, right? And all of a sudden the blue lights come in behind them. And the passenger says to the driver, "Oh man, we're busted." He says, "Quick, drink it all down and peel the label off." So he does, and the driver does while they're still driving down the road before he turns off. And the guy says, "Now what?" He says, "Stick the label on your head." So he's okay, sticks the label on his head. The driver sticks his label on his head. They pull over. The cop goes, he says, "Have you two been drinking tonight?" He says, "No, no, no, officer, we're on the patch."
Oh boy.
Oh yeah, no, there you go. That's
hey-o.
We're on the patch. That's from jokesoftheday.net, a fun website to go to. One last one. This one's slightly naughty, which means that I know that you will scold me at the end of this, Andrew, but I'm going to tell it anyway.
You better not be going to choir practice.
I'm not. I did choir on Saturday. Woman walks into a grocery store and asks the guy doing the stocking, says, "Do you have any nuts?" And the guy says, "No, ma'am." And she says, "Well, do you have any dates?" And he says, "Ma'am, if I don't have nuts, do you really think I have any dates?"
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, there you go. All right, well, that's our podcast for another week. When we come back, Andrew, it'll be in the middle of the Democrat convention where you and I will have to answer whether we're going to watch the Democrat convention, because I have not. I've really struggled with that question. Do I watch this thing or do I actually go off and have a life?
Well, Ed, because I'm a professional, it's not a struggle for me. No.
Well, that's a spoiler alert for next week's episode. So there you go, folks. But show up anyway when the Prince of Twitter, the Regent of RedState.com, comes back for another podcast. Thanks so much, Andrew. We'll talk next week.
Thank you, Edward. Thanks, everybody. See you then.